Hi there, it's Richard Berkeson back on Grassroots, the Minor Hockey Show, part two of the discussion with Dr. Steve Norris, who's in West in Calgary, and my co-host Dean Holden.
Cochrane,
Alberta, yeah, lovely little town. What's the name of that place, Dean, we went for breakfast, that great little...
The Cochrane Hotel.
The Cochrane
Steve and
Hotel.
I have never been there.
No, what a fantastic spot.
We don't know the waitress's names. We don't know the menu. We don't know the specials. Nothing.
Okay.
The only difference is I always walk out of there under my own power. With
oh dear! Oh dear! Now let's not cast stones because I've got some big ones here.
Here we go. All right, back to the topic. Question, Steve: what's the kind of education do you think our coaches? Or kind of education or training coaches in this sport need and why?
Okay, well, first off, rather than having a one size fits all sort of way of coaching, and the Coaching Association of Canada has produced different streams, community coach, et cetera, we really need to almost look at the target audience of a particular instructor and coach. Who are they coaching? And coaches can do different courses so that they can actually have a span of ranges. But, you know, you almost need, you become a qualified coach of 8-year-olds and under, let's say. And then you do a little bit more education, become a coach of 12-year-olds and under, and so forth, so that you could build up your whole sort of repertoire. But it's important to make sure then that the information, the knowledge, the experience that we give to our coaches and instructors is relevant to their target audience. Not saying they can't grow as the kids grow too. That's what I mean by, if you want to now coach the next age band up, you have to go and learn a little bit more about that. And also have some specific ones for maybe females, particularly through, you know, the sort of 10 through 14 year old age band, where there are some specific elements that might be most appropriate for coaching females, for example, and so that coaches can understand the challenges and the environment for their players. And the other thing is this aspect of not simply loading up people with knowledge on technique or tactics, but also really about the environment, the communication skills, creating a situation where kids will want to come back, you know, that to the next session, those type of things. So, and you know, rather than, you know, coaching in a way that is informative and proactive and not punitive.
The way the coaching program was reformatted some years ago was done according to the level of play, regardless of the age of the kids. So that if you're coaching 6 and under, let's say, you would take coach level 1. If you're coaching house league level, all you need is coach level 2. If you're coaching competitive hockey of a certain age range, like up to U16 or U17 or whatever it is, you would take the development level. But the range of age was quite broad. So if you were coaching competitive level kids, which is almost an oxymoron, you know, competitive level 7-year-olds, to, for instance, the team I'm coaching this year is U18 AA, which is not AAA, it's one level below that, but you need development 1, whether you're coaching 17-year-olds on my team or 7-year-olds or 8-year-olds, you know, that's the range. It's all done by the level you're coaching. And under the system that came in 15, 20 years ago, you could enter a level of coaching in the program according to where you're coaching with no background in training at all. So if you're a former player in Europe and you've never coached before and your child is now 11 years old playing competitive hockey, without having spent 1 hour of training in anything, you could go coach that kid if you took this one clinic. That's the structure there is now. There's no accommodation for age or anything.
Well, I do have a problem with just structuring around what we are describing as a competitive level of play, because it's going really to the wrong metric. It's not really looking at what really the needs of the players are in a long-term development structure.
Exactly.
And things will get missed in that regard. You've got to focus on the sort of age and stage of their development, and have the flexibility as a coach to deal with kids that are executing at that moment in time at different levels. Okay. Do you see what I'm saying? Which you'll equate to competitive level. I'm just right. saying executing, and be able to really dissect that to understand what actually are the strengths and weaknesses of these kids, and they are kids, and what really needs to prepare them for the next stage. Everything should be about understanding the almost the entry and exit levels of skill and knowledge and understanding of the game as the kid moves to the next stage, if you like. And I don't really like putting distinct lines in, but you know, we can use that very clearly and understand the chronology of that aspect, yet understand that simple chronology is not a good marker necessarily of a kid's development. So, you know, what are the ways in which people are truly evaluating progress of the kid across the multiple bandwidths of skill sets that the kid is meant to display?
Dean, you have
something? Yeah, this is great. This is going to tie in. It's not going to be random like everything else I do. I love that direction, Steve. And I was quite taken by a guest who was on John O'Sullivan's Changing the Game podcast. I just quickly pulled it up, October 25th, 2020. So listeners out there might want to check it. It's episode 191. How Belgium went from number 66 to number one in the world rankings with Belgian Football Association Director of Coach Education, Chris Vanderhagen. And this one came out, like I said, October 25th, 2020, but it was a replay because it came out, I think, earlier. I listened to this one a few times because I think it goes into some of the details that you just talked about. And a lot of the things that I took out of this went back to, I suppose, the machine, in this case, in our instance, we'll put it in the terms of the machine of hockey, the process. And my understanding, again, it's been a couple of years since I listened to this. You spoke about the negative influence the relative age effect has on Canadian hockey. Apparently what they did in Belgium, and this is what Chris talks about, is they removed their evaluation structure strictly based on age. So how we do it here by, you know, essentially 2-year breakdowns for the most part until you get to U18, which is a three-year range. But what they looked at is they looked more at developmental age. Where is the child now? So, you know, if you've got some really advanced 6-year-olds, like apparently they do in a certain association in Canada, in Ontario, it seems that they would put kids of similar ability, regardless of the age. So maybe you've got, you know, a loose definition of age. So around U8, let's look at who we have the best at our U8 level. But you know what? If there's a really good U7 or a U6 that, you know, is fairly homogeneous in their skill, maybe we should elevate them up to that level. And maybe some other lower U8s, we put them with lower U8s. So I took away that they're not looking to completely constrain using age, but they use it as a guide. And there's up and down movement above and beyond these age ranges. And then they adapt. They look at them. I can't remember the details, but I think it's at least twice a year. Where they can move people
I'm going to
up
interrupt
and down.
You right here. There are several, many examples of exactly what you're describing in many avenues in life, including sport. The challenge is it's a very sophisticated, emotionally
Yes.
mature system. And it's not widespread, unfortunately, because of that. It's very difficult. You need to have a competition and rule structure that will support that.
The
You need to have
machine,
an
the
administrative
process.
structure that supports that. And you need to have a very patient view. But you can look at, that's why I mentioned certain academies. I mean, look, prime example of certain outliers that have been brought through that. So if you look at FC Barcelona, right, and the farmhouse, the Massier, right, which is their developmental component. So they have a systematic way of progressing their players. They go to school, okay, regular school, and then they have a systematic development program, both off on the field and off the field, right? But they have the ability, as they did when they brought Messi in as a younger, undersized player into that environment, and were patient with him as they developed him, and they can do that. But these are sophisticated programs. You can see it in music academies and dance academies and other aspects of life, not simply in sport. But those are sophisticated programs. To translate that into the mass branch level we're talking about in hockey would take a seismic shift of leadership and understanding, right? And that's what certain programs have tried to do. But I've mentioned Brad Laisel and the AMP program.
Yes.
Certainly what he's trying to do. And I've got another paper here that from swimming that shows, you know, at the very least, you should stick with single year age bands. Well, hockey doesn't do that, you know, and so we build the relative age effect even further than the simple 12 months, because even in a 12 month period, as you know, through certain phases of life, there's a massive difference between someone born at the administrative start of the year compared to the administrative end. So it doesn't matter where you put that line in the sand, January the 1st, or maybe like soccer, I think they're like July 31st or August 1st. Doesn't matter, but whoever's closest or furthest away from that will either be advantaged or discriminated by that process. The broader your age bands, the worse that comes in terms of the outcome. And we know in hockey, you know, be born largely, arguably
January,
January,
February,
March,
March,
right?
Yeah. Should Hockey Canada at least go down to single age bands?
Okay, before I
oh, sorry.
Dean, just before Steve attacks that question, we had that in Hockey Canada. When the initiation program was rolled out in 1980, I think it was around 86, and I was part of the rollout of that across the country, we rolled it out in Ottawa. The age range of the A, B, C, D manuals, there were four manuals of X number of lessons each. I think it was 20 lessons each. And the group of us in Ottawa rewrote those manuals, version two. We did the rewrite. That was for ages 5 to 10 years old. There was no distinction made whether you were a seven-year-old in your second year of hockey or a nine-year-old in your first year of hockey or even a 10-year-old starting hockey for the first time. You went into the initiation program and you went according to the level of ability that you had at that time. So a nine-year-old could go in and be in level C manual, and a six-year-old could be in 11B manual. When that was pushed aside to go to novice hockey and Adam hockey and novice AAA and all this stuff, all of that went by the wayside. Hockey Canada changed. This is where the leadership role rears its ugly head a little bit here, Steve, I think. Hockey Canada decided to rename the initiation program coach level. And as if coaching was, it was all about their coaching, when actually you're teaching kids how to, you know, to play the game, get them out there and playing. So we did have that in Canada. And the question I pose now, Steve, is what if in 1885, when some people went to this building in downtown Montreal and decided to put a rink in there and said, I'd like my kids to try to learn this game. It's called bandy. And we kind of whack a chunk of
cow manure.
Frozen cow manure across. Well, we're going to put it indoors on Stanley Street in downtown Montreal. We're going to call it the Victoria Rink because she's our sovereign. And let's just make the rink really small for kids and put markings on the ice for kids. And what if it had started that way? Instead of making the space 200 X feet between the two streets, which is what that building is. That warehouse was between two streets, Stanley and Drummond, and it was 200 feet wide. What if it had been kid focused and centered from the beginning? What would the game look like today? Steve?
Well, I mean, that, yeah, would look probably radically different because we take adult games largely and we place children into that environment without understanding it. Some sports have made great inroads into this, baseball, tennis. Who else has done scaling well?
Well, soccer has done it, basketball.
Badminton. Yeah. So, they all understand that. And unfortunately, you know, we've had a lot of backlash in hockey because people, adults who don't understand the process, you know, somewhat ignorant, and I mean that nicely, ignorant of the overall process, say it's not hockey. You know, and so they have, it's like the whole hitting issue. You know, they like putting their kids in harm's way, not understanding the long-term repercussions. And the research there has been astronomical for years, and yet people still go into denial about it. It's changing a little bit, but, you know, it's remarkable. And so we almost are completely ignorant and blind to the process and understanding. And so when we get to, as I said, scaling, you know, we make it, we just don't do it largely. And so when we have done it in hockey, you know, as USA Hockey in conjunction with the NHL and their studies show pretty conclusively, the increase in involvement in the game, puck handling, puck contact time, number of shots, number of saves, all this type of stuff, amount of time actually on the ice, all these type of things, amount of fun as measured by what the kids actually say, you know, is important. I remember once for USA Hockey, we were on an international surface. I think we were in Chicago, and it was me, Igor Larionov, Brian Burke, and others. And Hockey Canada ran, USA Hockey ran a 9 stations on this ice surface, right? And they had like 5 kids to every station. So the place was packed and humming, and they ran this for like 30 minutes, 40 minutes. And Brian and someone else, I'm trying to think, maybe it was Mr. Grillo, yes. We're actually doing a voice commentary to the parents in the stands about what was going on in the ice and was explaining it. And when the kids came off the ice, they were exhausted, they'd had fun, they were far more engaged because they had very little downtime in the entire period, and just showing what you could do with the same amount of time on ice compared to normal, where you'd have maybe 25 kids on that huge surface of ice, most of the time doing flow drills, which are basically, they'd be watered down adult versions of basically 8 seconds of activity and 2 to 2.5 minutes standing at the back of the line doing nothing, you know? And so it's just the way of changing the way people understand things, you know? And one of the problems with coaching at times is you often coach in the way you were coached and what you learned, rather than there being any sort of critical thought in the process. And that's not true. And that's a blanket statement, but it's often the way. Or worse still, or the opposite is you don't want to coach like the way you were taught. So you go in some completely opposite direction because you had a bad time or whatever.
One of the statements that we've seen elsewhere, not just in hockey, is there's no player development without coach development, but we can't get organizations to buy into that. People are spending.
That's exactly right. The long-term athlete development, that actually should be the coaching manual and actually then fleshed out a little bit further, because it's just a guide, it's just a framework. And then the coach also has to have the wherewithal and the understanding to adapt to the situation, the context specificity of his or her situation, his environment, her environment, the equipment they have, who they're dealing with. So they have to have this sort of background knowledge that we've equipped them with, depending on the audience, and then they have to be able to make decisions that are context specific.
But Steve, I'm just a volunteer.
Yeah, that's it. And we let them get away with everything. You see, here's the thing. Volunteerism is not an excuse for poor performance.
Having run headlong into that many, many, many dozens of times, you know, you see a coach. I watched a coach the other day on the ice just before my team, a very large man. He's a big guy on the ice with a group of, I don't know whether they were 11 years old, 12 years old. So they're obviously a lot smaller. He's participating in a simple little drill with the kids, and a kid, you know, they have to pass the puck between the two of them, go down and shoot on a goaltender. It was a very short distance, you know, 30 feet or so. The kid didn't pass it on his stick, and he wasn't mean when he shouted at the kid. He just said, "What kind of a pass is that?" as he's going down with this child. So while the coach is very well-meaning and is very good with kids in general, I seriously question, you know, what are you doing that you are questioning the child who is passing with you? You're twice his size, three times his weight, and why are you doing the drill, period? And I see coaches involved in these things all the time. They have to do the drills with the kids. It would be like saying, we're going to take Margaret Atwood, one of Canada's greatest writers, stick her in a grade 7 classroom, and we're going to teach writing novel writing with our 12-year-olds. Let's all do that right now, folks.
Yeah. I mean, this subject, you know, it all comes down to the coaches and instructors understanding exactly what the task is and having the tools and the skills to be able to do that. And understanding that not everyone is suited to both genders. Not everyone is suited to every age group necessarily, and and therefore the motivation of the individual, which is why the emotional intelligence aspect of our coaches and instructors is an important piece to get after, and to make sure then that equipped with the soft skills first, the right people in coaching, right? Rather than just a bunch of paper qualifications. And the other thing that we've allowed to let slip really is the practical side of the evaluation of coaches. You know, we allow them to go and sit in a classroom, they do a weekend course, and then we say, you're ready to coach, without really ever spending the time or investing, and it is time, of course, in actually seeing them coach and actually providing feedback. We've lost sight of that element. Even in
mentorship.
Yeah.
Steve,
and that's another reason why the idea of having a technical lead in minor associations, because the money's there there could be a whole avenue of people who earn a living by teaching all the volunteers, coaching the volunteers, mentoring all the volunteers. There's a business model there.
That was an important recommendation from the 1999 Molson Summit that was held in Toronto, that was not attended by a lot of minor hockey people, but certainly that was a key one. One of their 11 recommendations was paid mentorship. Well, Hockey Canada took up that mantle and created a national NCMP, National Coach Mentorship Program. They have a lovely manual that I still have on my shelf here somewhere. And
I use mine as bookends.
Yeah. And I remember having a conversation with a couple of people from Hockey Canada about it and saying, are you going to set up, you know, mentors, like regional mentors, branch mentor? Well, no, we're not going to do that. We're leaving it up to the branches.
I was told Canada is too big geographically. We cannot follow the same models as Finland and Sweden, which I understand, but it always seemed like these obstacles would get thrown up whenever we would suggest this, Richard.
So having served as a mentor in associations for a number of years and as a head mentor or whatever title you want to call it, organizations do not want or do not feel the need or are not educated enough to understand the need to hire people to work with coaches. But not only that, when they do hire people at, you know, whatever nominal amount they're giving them, what exactly are they mentoring? Are they mentoring the kind of coaching that went on in 1981? or are they mentoring the kind of coaching we need, such as, you know, the ecological dynamics that is now coming about in various sports all over the world and now into hockey, particularly in USA? You know, these are rhetorical questions I'm posing, but I have another question for you, Steve. Going back to what I mentioned earlier, or what you actually mentioned earlier, you've taught at the university level, correct?
Yeah.
How come you've never taught grade four?
Because I wasn't trained as a teacher, and that wasn't my direction. I wasn't going to go into education. I taught at the only at the graduate student level, and it was more provide information and discussion and seminars and mentorship than it was actually just sort of formal. I'm just going to stand in the room and impart information. Yeah.
I'm trying to cleverly draw a parallel between what you said about being comfortable with certain age groups or certain genders. A lot of teachers will say, I do not want to spend a minute with grade sevens and eights. I'd only want to teach, you know, grade four or five, or I only want to teach upper high school. I don't want any part of the grade nines. University teachers will say, I wouldn't go into a grade 10 classroom and teach English. Are you crazy? You know, so I'm just wondering if the opportunity afforded itself, do you see yourself as somebody who would feel comfortable with elementary school students of a certain age, high school students of a certain age? Is there a comfort zone we all have that we should be okay with?
Yeah, I believe so, for sure. That's why I said it's not simple paper qualifications. It's the right person for the right place, right? And even the role of, and the differences, and I might get into trouble for saying this, but perhaps in general differences between the maternal instincts of perhaps female coaches versus paternal instincts of male. I may be shot down totally for that, but I think that's just an example, I think, of differences in people and the fact that it's not necessarily a coach with a particular skill set being able to coach everyone. There's one, the motivation of the individual, like the example you gave of people not wanting to teach or coach little kids. There's a skill set of the persona that is required, maybe even a higher level of patience. It's like one of the things I talk about with the golf pros is that, you know, we talk about those that are good at teaching total beginners in the game of golf when their own skill set is supreme. And can they actually relate to someone that just can't hit that little white ball in the same way they can, right? And yet they have to explain it and have that capability. So are you able to do that with kids? What about, you know, a group of 35 to 45-year-old women that are wanting to take up the game for the first time? Are you good with that group of people? What about seniors who have retired that played the game a bit but want to get better? You know, so there's an element of the coach and the knowledge you need, but there's the coach and knowledge you need for a specific group, and then there's the persona and the soft skills required to communicate and establish that relationship with that particular group.
And that differentiation is not made in this country in hockey. Junior coaches coach junior, and then we take junior coaches who have only coached junior or played pro and expect them to be guest speakers for a minor hockey organization and be able to relate in any way, shape, or form to what the coaches of the 8-year-olds are dealing with.
Well, what we're really talking about is a really good, hard, serious look at the coaching and instruction system, and that would be appropriate. And it's not that you have to throw everything, that the bulk of the knowledge is there. It's just at times we're too focused on things that are not necessarily the key factors we should get on for the long term. And so we don't teach about communication and the softer skills and understanding and emotional intelligence. We rush for technical stuff. We rush for tactics, you know, and that's another area then when we start to not evaluate the players effectively, you know, and particularly within the context of where they are. And we use competition usually as the only way of evaluating people.
Dean, you had something you wanted to throw in there?
Well, yeah, I think Steve just, made that note. He differentiated the, the hard skills from the soft skills, across genders, across ages, across skill levels. Ultimately, what I take away from that is we need to really keep in mind what our target audience is and who is best suited to work at that level. And unfortunately, it goes back to the machinery of hockey and the process. Often in minor hockey, the people that are volunteer coaching are parents of somebody who's on the team, and they work their way up, and they know what they know, and they don't know what they don't know. And that's just what we have. It's not a, by any means, a professional model. It's very difficult to herd the cats in the proper direction and educate everybody appropriately. We take what we can get, because we've got to have somebody on the bench, somebody on the ice, somebody in the room. Otherwise, the game doesn't get played. We need an official. Yeah, there's a lot of challenges there. And, there's a lot of best practices, shall we say, or better practices that will definitely have challenges and we might never get to. So
but here's the thing about all that. So we've just described many things that are all appropriate right at the senior level, right? How many officials, and do we even need officiating in the younger age groups at times?
Exactly.
Kids play games on the playground all the time, right? With no problem whatsoever. It's when we start to put value in the outcome of the game in the eyes of the parents in particular, right? Who, got to hold some people's behaviors in check. They want it to look like the adult system, blah, 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 blah. So it needs a complete recast of what we're trying to do. We're having the same view in swimming. You go to a provincial swim meet, it looks like the Olympics. We've got all these people in white coats and white trousers and shirts. You've got three timekeepers per lane at a 14 and under meet, right? You've got a referee, you've got stroke judges, all this type of stuff. Yeah, you don't need that. You don't need electronic timing. You don't need a $50,000 electronic timing system and a $50,000 scoreboard to put all the results up, really. All this type of stuff. The kids are there to have fun, swim fast, and try to do it within the rules, basically. And so, as we look at it, we just envelop the sport, and particularly competition, it's bloody competition again, in without understanding its role in development.
I hate doing this, but I'd like to bring it to a close with one last question, and it's corollary. Dean, it's the one that you gave me to ask Steve, so we're going to put him on the spot. Steve, you've been appointed King of Hockey Canada. Congratulations on your appointment. What steps would you take to improve coach and player development, and what impediments or challenges do you foresee?
Richard, you can insert the Jeopardy music here.
Would play for quite a while. Okay, what?
What would you change first?
Well, one, the expectation that the first rung on the ladder, you've got to change the culture and people's value sets. People do not value, right, getting a level of instruction that is actually meaningful at the lower levels. And by the lower levels, I mean the younger levels, right? The start of the sport, and then how are you going to keep them, the stay? You think all sports have a start, stay, and maybe for a few succeed streams, right? And some sports have starting all the way through the lifespan, like golf, right? Hockey doesn't have that. The entry point to hockey is a relatively narrow age band. Okay, so the reality of that and of starting is that who are the best coaches of starting hockey? What is that age band? And we force it fairly young, but what about all the, kids coming out of other sports that want to pick up hockey still in middle school and high and junior high and high school, and who's going to coach them? And then we have the coaches that of the kids that already got a reasonable modicum of skill sets. How do we start to improve them? And then gradually how and when do we filter out into the succeed stream, those that are going to really want to start to invest themselves and time in the sport? The key thing is we've got to be honest about how the time investment of our volunteers to become coaches and instructors, because everyone and their dog thinks they can do it based off whatever they've watched or whatever they did as a kid and they learned 30,000 years ago. Because here's one of the problems, you know, we've to change the system. Our coaches right now, if we look at roughly the age band, let's say 25 to 40 years of age, right? They played hockey 20 years ago to 30 years ago and were taught by a certain group who themselves played hockey 30 years before that. And so you've got this time warp of delayed movement, even of knowledge in the game. So unless someone's a real lifelong learner and keeping up with things, they arrive and have been influenced by people who played the game half a century ago, basically, right? When people didn't even have to wear helmets and they skated around with gay abandon. I'm using the word gay in the broadest sense of that, you know, to just whatever. Okay, I don't want to get into trouble for using that language. And I'm certainly not disparaging to a particular sector of humanity. But they just skated around without a care in the world, that type of stuff. And I'm getting myself in deep water, I think. And or thin ice, so let me use that. And so, you know, my where was I going with all that? We have this time warp even of coaching. And so one of the things is we need to make sure that we're always relevant in the here and now. But one of the key things is people think they can get away and start coaching hockey from attending an in-class session for a weekend. And we let them get away with that.
Steve, it's not even a weekend anymore. It's online for 3 or 4 hours and away you go.
Great. Wonderful. You know, so we get, you know, we get what we deserve. We get what we invest. So that has to change, you know, and I tie it to insurance and a few other things like that, in that you're not equipped to step on this ice, from all sorts of things, from behavioral aspects through to your knowledge level, to safe environments, to whatever it might be. I look at the governance structure of the organization and its relationship with the branches and PSOs. And I would be talking to the feds about that. And the provinces, of course. Well, I think we almost need legislation to help frame that. What do you mean, when do you start?
When do you start as supreme ruler and dictator of Hockey Canada?
Emperor.
King.
Oh, the Dark Lord.
Yes. Darth Norris.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think they could afford me.
So true. They'd want you to volunteer, Steve.
When you're referring to governance, Steve, are you Hockey Canada, or for any other sport in Canada, I guess, are not really answerable to any body. I don't mean anybody. I mean any body. Sport Canada sort of is the bank, you know, they're the ATM for all the sports.
Well, they actually are meant to be. They're almost, I don't know whether it's a charter or whatever, but it grants the national sport organization rights. It does come ultimately from what I believe to be the federal government. You can't just create an NSO. There's a process, there's got to be a recognition, and so forth. And there are rules around that, but I think the government has been loath, and Sport Canada in particular, to be enter into the political realm, even to this day. So just the most recent stuff with Hockey Canada, that's been driven, although Sport Canada is a government department within still Canadian heritage, I believe, you know, it's really at the ministerial level, right at the government senior level, that where we've seen that action occur, not down through Sport Canada per se, right?
If we go back,
so
I was going to say, if we
the law unto itself,
yeah. If we go back to what you said earlier, that really it's been up to there are 13 branches in Hockey Canada, that it's been up to the branches historically and in the present, to run their own show, so to speak, with certain, you know, parameters that they have to stay within. Like, for instance, the rules of the game are Canada wide. Whether you're playing in Nova Scotia or Manitoba, a 2-minute penalty is a 2-minute penalty. It's not 3 minutes. It's not a minute and a half. But if you're the king of Hockey Canada, Steve, do you retain the kind of autonomy that the branches have, or would you adjust that or tweak that in some way?
Well, that's what I mean about the challenge is getting people to vote themselves off the island when you start changing culture and governance. And so that's why, as I said, it may take some leadership from the federal government to say, you need to really sort this out, otherwise your charter is gone or whatever. And for the PSOs, the provincial governments, to back that up and say, we need to change something. We've got to get this organizational structure done differently. We've got to have a governance structure that makes sense. Still have the regional representation, for sure, but to how it sort of filters up to the NSO. So the NSO has some teeth and has some leadership capability, and that is supported by probably some legislation.
What would you advise minor hockey coaches, since this is a minor hockey podcast, what would you advise minor hockey coaches in terms of advice going forward?
I would ask them to think about the age groups that they're truly able to influence, and to learn as much as they can from certainly some hockey resources, but other activities around those particular age groups, mm-hmm. and get some advice. Maybe also get some advice from even phys ed, basic phys ed, I don't mean basic, but from phys ed teachers who have been taught a curriculum mm-hmm. for, you know, certain age groups or whatever. But I'd look to some other sports, and but really focus on that, and certainly learn from younger age groups and older age groups, but don't base yourself around some false impression that you're dealing with a watered down NHL environment. Okay, you're dealing with an environment to the age group you're dealing with, and understand your role in their lives. It's their lives, not simply yours. And you are part of the process of mentorship on the conveyor belt of their life, which is why I didn't mean to be flippant by saying one of your jobs is to get those U14s to be ready to be U16s, you know, and that mm-hmm. process of handing off. What right. should they look like when you come to the end of your tenure with that group, okay, as you hand them off to the next group? And because we use multiple age bands, you know, you've got a couple of years and you're going to have a group that you're retaining as the next younger group coming to you. And so are you actually conversing with the people who are going to be handing off to you as well, so that you start to actually have a bit of a conveyor belt? But, you know, in other words, looking down below your group as well as looking up and above your group.
I love the conveyor belt visual. Dean, was there anything else you'd like to add before you and Steve take off to the Cochrane Hotel for ginger ale and breakfast?
Well, I wanted to thank Steve here for being so generous with his time this morning. Friday the 13th, we're trying not to get into any bad situations, superstitious wise. But I think, you know, Steve, it sounds like there's a really big challenge ahead of hockey in Canada and sport in Canada. Where do you see, based on our current trajectory, where do you see minor hockey in Canada, both, I guess, nationally and internationally? So 10 years from now, what does it look like as a futurist, what do you predict?
Well, despite all my comments up until this point, you know, I am an optimist, and there are so many good things that do occur in minor hockey. And there are some very good people. It's just that I think everyone's rushing around trying to fit everything in and just falling between stools a little bit, and then not understanding the conveyor belt in reality for these kids. I am also, as I said earlier, a little bit pessimistic. I think there's increasing fragmentation in minor hockey. And therefore, with that comes less leadership. One might argue that maybe more sort of competition by different mindsets is actually a good thing. Well, not if people are still rushing off and actually just segregating into things that are not very good. And I'm worried about participation numbers. I'm worried about the cost. I'm worried because so much is focused on travel and competition without understanding the process and the output as opposed to the outcome. Okay, so output is the investment people are putting into the thing, right, through the process, which leads eventually to an outcome. That's what we should focus on, the process and the output, how much is actually going into this, both from the coaching and from the players themselves. And then that ultimately will result in what we get. And so I'm concerned about that fragmentation. I'm concerned about spiraling costs and the ever push of increased equipment and complexity, which is unnecessary. I use the analogy I've sometimes said in alpine skiing, you know, modern skis and modern boots. I mean, so we force these young kids into these big, non-compliant plastic boots, and we put them on skis that are designed to turn, right? They will turn on, they set the edge and the ski will turn. But so you've got a particular plate and a binding that the boot is attached to. So if you get a certain amount of angle on the snow and you at a certain velocity, it'll turn a particular arc, right? The key thing is, how much input did the actual young skier create to actually do that, as opposed to having them on a 2x4 in a pair of old Adidas Stan Smiths, you know, with no ankle support? And can they turn and can they lean and edge a 2x4 in plimsolls, basically? You know, so in other words, can they truly ski? That's the key thing. So, you know, for me, it's about you improve the level of equipment with the level of core capability, first and foremost. And so you don't invest in the Formula One car until you can drive the Honda Civic or a go-kart or whatever it might be. And so just getting everyone, but, you know, I've had people say to me, parents in particularly, and I mentioned in the sport of skiing, well, Stephen, what if money is no problem? You know, why can't we do all that? They just don't get the understanding of the process and the output, which is the challenge that we've got to get through to everyone, right? And that we want large participation numbers as long as possible. And the developmental window is broad, and the point at which various people start to really execute at a level is quite varied. And yet we pick and choose very young. This whole stratification of kids is based around competition, AAA and AA and all this at young ages. I mean, it's kind of pathetic in a way. You know, we can have stratification. Tiering is a good tool when it's related to the composition, the content of the program, not simply competitive outcome, right? That's a very poor master competition. So tiering is good. It goes back to your point about having kids of a certain ability, training, et cetera, to get, et cetera, together. You know, best on best. I do it with swimming all the time, right? Where we bring groups together, mainly on a thematic. Maybe we're going to do breaststroke with the top 10 breaststrokers in the province at the moment of a particular age to give them some uplift. But what we also do is make sure all their coaches are there, so that when they go back to their home programs, they've learned something that they can give to all the other kids in the program, right? And uplift that group. And so we just don't even have that kind of attitude about what we're trying to do. We get so focused on the short-term competitive outcome that we lose sight of the conveyor belt.
I love that conveyor belt. I'm going to steal that. I'm going to use it somewhere. I mean, if we took all the teenagers from age 13 to 16, 17, who have never played hockey before and threw them all in the rink and just said, okay, here's, you know, some pucks and balls and toys and put on a helmet and skates and go. Some will be okay. Some will be brutal. Some will be great. Who cares, as long as they're playing? The key is to play. The key is to participate. On that note, we are going to bring it to a close. Dean, thank you very much for your assistance and in getting Steve out of the Cochrane Hotel and into
Yeah, he was leaning on me a lot, Richard. Yeah, he leaned a lot. Like, and it wasn't a direct linear route. Mm-hmm. It was a non-linear, ecologically dynamic route to get him out.
I can't wait to go back to that spot and experience an evening as opposed to just the breakfast that we had there, Dean. Steve, thank you very much for your time for this two-parter. I don't even know what to call it, the conveyor belt of life. I'm not sure what, but I appreciate it. My thanks to you especially, and to Dean and to the listeners. You've been listening to Grassroots, the Minor Hockey Show podcast. This was part two of our discussion with Dr. Steve Norris about all things related to development and coaching and and where we are, where we should be going. If you have any comments, it's richard@grassrootsminorhockey.com. And as always, I will see you in a rink.